Oxition number 12910, reel 13.
Zimra, reel 13.
Thank you. Brigadier Bates and I used to discuss these things, the situation in the reserve in general. The substantive provincial commissioner at the time was a man called Edward Windley, who was a very fine man indeed and has always been very much respected as a senior administrative officer, and he went to the top. I believe he became a colonial governor in due course. I'm not sure where. After a while, he went on leave, and his place was taken by another man who was in the same kind of mould as Windley. His name was Johnston, who incidentally had been, an Oxford rowing blue. He was a very approachable man, and in due course, Brigadier Bates and I went to Johnston, and we suggested to him that in our view there was something going on in the reserves which was not quite right. We didn't understand it, we didn't know. We chatted with him, and in due course we put our experiences and our thoughts on paper in the form of a memorandum, and we gave it to Johnson. Johnson got in touch with Nairobi. He agreed with us. I'm not suggesting, obviously, that Bill Bates and I were the only people who were perhaps perturbed. There were other little signs and portents beginning to come along which district commissioners out in the reserves, out in the around the country, had begun to notice. And I think that what we had to say probably tallied and fitted into the overall jigsaw puzzle. Jigsaw of the general scenario. Anyway, Johnson sent our memorandum down to Nairobi and also telephoned to a man called Davis, who was, a senior government officer. I think he was called the Secretary for Native Affairs. I'm not sure. Anyway, he had the ear of Mitchell, the governor of the colony. Mitchell was completely Olympian, and he was an old-time governor of the old school. There was very little that he didn't know about East and Central Africa. He'd had a very tough war, and I believe he was a tired man, a very tired man. He was, I think, almost unapproachable, even by those who were closest to him. He was by no means an easy man to get anywhere near. But his knowledge was encyclopedic on that part of Africa. He'd spent a very great deal of his service in East and Central Africa. Davis, I know, went to this Olympian figure and told him what he'd gleaned from around, not only from us, but I suspect from a composite picture of that others were producing, with perhaps special reference to the Nyeri reserves. And I know about this because much later on, my commissioner of police, a man called O'Rourke, did refer to my memorandum with Bates, and I know that Davis did approach Mitchell. What happened between Davis and Mitchell, I shall never know. All I do know is that Davis left Kenya in due course. How many months afterwards, I have no idea, but he left Kenya and never came back to it. Whether Davis pressed Mitchell harder than he wanted to be pressed and got the sack, or whether he resigned, I don't know. I have no idea. Be that as it may, he came home, retired from the colonial service, and eventually became governor of the Isle of Man. He died not very long ago. But what transpired between Mitchell and Davis, I don't know. I have no idea, no means of knowing. Davis had come up, I may say, and to Neri before going to Mitchell, and he'd grilled both Bates and myself and the provincial commissioner. And he went down to Nairobi with a fairly clear picture in his mind. He agreed with what we all had said. He had a look round the reserves himself, and I think he went down, I think probably he went down and went to Nairobi and went to Mitchell, believing himself that things were not right, that there was something going on around the reserves. Now, Mitchell, as I learnt subsequently, was being pushed by two very formidable sources. One, he was being pushed, there was a man called at that time, Bishop Beater, who incidentally has recently died, aged 91, 92. Beater was bishop, at that time, he subsequently became an archbishop, was bishop of Nairobi, of Mombasa. He lived in Nairobi. He was a very tall, very imposing figure, very highly educated, probably very arrogant. I got to know him two or three years later when I was down in Mombasa, because he used to come down there from time to time. His rays and mine did not mingle. That's as much as I can really say about that. I found myself not on the same wavelength at all. But Beecher was highly formidable. On behalf of the Africans, he was pushing Mitchell like mad, saying that independence would have to come to Kenya. Mitchell found himself... Mitchell, a tired man, found himself at odds with this because his own experience convinced him that Africans in that country were nowhere near ready for independence. Now, that was one prong of being levelled at Mitchell. The other prong was from the Colonial Office. In the Colonial Office at that time, there was another highly formidable figure called Andrew Cohen, later Sir Andrew Cohen. Cohen was committed to decolonization and to independence throughout British colonial territories. And he had achieved senior rank in the Colonial Office and was... very much listened to by everybody. If Cohen said something, the likelihood would be that it would be listened to with very considerable respect and probably embodied in Colonial Office policy, Whitehall policy. And I think that Mitchell was being squeezed between Cohen and Beecher. Now, it's not only my opinion, this. I have heard this vaguely before, a long time before. But some while ago, perhaps 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I was discussing all this with a close friend of mine called Williams, who lives near here. He lived 3 or 4 miles away from here, and I used to see a lot of him. He was an education officer in Uganda and in Tanganyika, and he used to come to Kenya a lot, and he knew Mitchell very well indeed. He also knew Beecher. Whether I can't remember whether he knew Cohen personally, but he was on personal terms with Mitchell and on personal terms also with Beecher. He was convinced that Mitchell was being squeezed between Cohen and Beecher. I had to suggest this to him because he was a rather a reticent sort of man on this sort of thing, and he'd in the closing stages of his life, he had forgotten a great deal. But I remember suggesting this to him, and he came down hard on this particular precept. So it's not merely my thoughts. It is, there's no shadow of doubt. There were others who thought the same thing. Mitchell, against his own better judgment, was being pushed towards African independence by these two powerful sources, Whitehall, per Cohen, and Beecher on the spot. I don't know whether that's clear.
Yes, it is. But when you say that you weren't on the same wavelength with Beecher, you don't mean to say that that was a political disagreement over the question of decolonization?
Oh, no. I never presumed to discuss anything political with Beecher at all. It was purely and simply our own everyday little chattings, the odd chattings that I did have with this powerful man. I mean, I was only a superintendent of police. He was the Bishop of Mombasa, the heir of the governor, and he was on a different flight to me altogether. And I simply sat at the feet of the great man, as it were.
So did you get any indication as to the reception of your joint memorandum with Bill Bates?
Never. The only time I ever heard any reference to it was from my own Commissioner of Police in passing later on. He simply referred to the fact that I had already passed on to him, of course, my thoughts about what was going on in the reserve. He said, I'm glad that you did what you did. As a matter of fact, I had heard something about this memorandum which you compiled with Bates, something to that extent, but it was very much in passing, because he was already himself in possession of my own thoughts and others' thoughts on this African attitude. Well, after this, little pointers began to predominate in those Nyeri reserves. Farmers would find signs and symbols among their labour. There would be dead cats hung up. There would be a sullen attitude and deliberate disobedience by labour. There would be little acts of sabotage here and there. Nothing much to begin with that you could get hold of. But these reports started to come in from around the around the area. And I suspect also, I think, in fact I'm pretty sure, that they were happening outside the Nehru district, in other Kikuyu areas as well, similar sort of things. They were beginning to add up, and at the commissioners' conference in Nairobi, we had to attend roughly about once a month, once every 6 weeks. All senior officers had to attend the commissioners' conference in Nairobi, and reports from other areas began to be collated. So far as I was concerned, there came a time, and by then, I think it must have been 51, early 51, I had gone to play cricket about an hour's journey from my headquarters in Nehru. To this day, I don't quite know, but I had taken with me a wireless van and a European wireless expert, signals expert. To this day, I don't quite know why I did this, whether I had a sudden rush of blood to the head and thought, well, I wonder if there's anything going to happen. If so, an hour's journey away from my headquarters, I must be kept in touch. It was a two-way system. And we got to the place. I changed into cricket gear. The match was about to begin. The radio man had set up his wireless installation. And suddenly a message came through from Nehru to say that an oath-taking ceremony had been taking place in the Nehru Reserves. I didn't then quite know what an oath-taking ceremony was, but I guessed that something was wrong, so I quickly returned to Nehru an hour away. So I never took part in the cricket match. I can't remember the subsequent march of events over that particular oath-taking ceremony, whether it was indeed the first that took place there, in those reserves, I've no idea. There might have been others which had occurred which nobody knew anything about. Because I would emphasize that the Kikuyu were a very obscure tribe. You never knew what they were thinking, what they were saying, what they were doing. They were quiet, reserved, almost an undercover lot of people, as far as I was concerned. Mark you, I couldn't speak to them. I couldn't understand what they said. All I could do was form opinion on external evidence, what they looked like, and how they seemed to me to behave. Anyway, this drizzled on, this kind of thing, and one learnt of the progress of things at commissioners' conferences. After 2 years in Nehru...
Did you get to know at that stage what the oath-taking ceremonies involved?
Yes, because, as a matter of fact, a young officer, a young inspector there at that time called Ian Henderson, who became illustrious in East Africa... He was transferred to me to try and penetrate whatever was going on. He'd been born in Kenya, and he'd been brought up in among the Kikuyu, and he spoke Kikuyu fluently. There was also another man who became not quite so illustrious as Ian Henderson, a man called Bernard Ruck. Both these two got highly decorated for later on for their penetration work into Mau Mau. Both of these two could talk Kikuyu, and through them I learnt quite a bit about what these oath-taking ceremonies consisted of. Africans were constrained by this by the commanding cabal in each place were constrained to take an oath of disobedience to Europeans. At that particular stage, the first oaths were not much more than disobedience causing general disorganization, mayhem, small acts of sabotage, and the rest of it. I believe I'm right in saying that there were eventually, when Mau Mau had reached its zenith, something like 6 or 8 oaths in ascending order, coming to the most dreadful, obscene oath-takings that it's possible to imagine. I'm not going to attempt to say anything about them. In fact, I don't even know quite what they really were, but I know that they were quite horrible, quite obscene, and murderous too. It was murder of Europeans and constraint upon servants employed by Europeans. And this, in fact, during the Mau Mau, African servants loyal for years to their European employers were forced by fear of death to let in the gangs in an attempt to murder these people, murder the Europeans. Strangely enough, the list of European fatalities, was right through the Mau Mau, was surprisingly light. Now, I should say, we're leading up, gradually, to the climax, or a climax. But when I got first up to Nery, and first got to know Brigadier Bates and some of the others, I found that one of the really good things that had happened in Kenya before I got there was the formation of an organization called the Kenya Police Reserve. Now, this meant that Europeans, Asians, and Asians particularly, and in some areas certain African tribes, would be put into uniform, police uniform, and would serve in their own areas in a defensive capacity. In Nery, this entailed, there were no Africans in the Kenya Police Reserve. There were, I think, a very few Asians, but it was mainly concerned with Europeans. And it was a ludicrous situation in many ways, because we had, living in Nery, a lot of people who come from India, retired from India, and some of these people had been in very high senior ranking jobs. I remember one in Nery, a major general. There was another, an air vice marshal, his name was Smart, and he'd been in the big Habonair affair in Iraq. He'd been the air officer commanding there. People of that ilk. And there was a very senior naval officer as well. And there were quite a lot of them. And the ludicrous situation that would happen, these people cheerfully donned Kenya Police Reserve uniforms. I remember a major general coming into my office on one occasion, I being a mere police superintendent, saluting me and saying, "Good morning, sir." So I leapt to my feet and said, "Good morning, sir. Will you sit down in my chair and let us talk?" that was the kind of thing. These people, realizing the security aspect, had gladly joined the Kenya Police Reserve. And I was very interested in this organization, and I fostered it to the best of my ability. We had numerous exercises, talks about what was happening around the place. This was after the initial beginning of things. when things were beginning to hot up. But the organisation was there when I got there. It merely needed a bit of a push, which I tried to give it. And my Commissioner of Police in Nairobi was particularly interested in this and was concerned that every regular police officer should foster the Kenya Police Reserve with all dispatch. So this was a thriving organisation, and there's no shadow of doubt that relatively few European casualties throughout Kenya during the whole Mau Mau insurrection was to a large extent due to the excellence of this Kenya Police Reserve. And I think probably Mitchell had, in his wisdom, had been responsible for it. Mitchell, the governor. So we were gradually leading up to a climax. After 2 years, which would bring us 49 to 50, late 49 to late 50 to late 51, I was transferred down to Mombasa, where I was transferred as a superintendent in charge of the police in Mombasa and the coast province generally. My headquarters was Mombasa, but my jurisdiction was throughout the whole of the coast province. I was a provincial officer, provincial police officer. just after I got down there, it was announced that there would be a highly secret, I got news of it in code, that there would be a highly secret operation called Jock Scott. And Jock Scott was intended to round up a number of Africans who were believed to be at the root of what we were already starting to call the Mau Mau cause, the Mau Mau insurrection, which is what it was. By this time, it had become apparent that Jomo Kenyatta was ahead of it, that he had a small inner cabal of Africans around him, and that they headed this widespread undercover movement, and that it was being fostered throughout the independent schools. There was a system of African independent schools throughout Kenya. And Jomo Kenyatta had an influential position among these independent schools, and he was fostering this, and he was using the independent schools as a training ground for his subversive purposes. I'm not suggesting now that this Mau Mau was new. It wasn't. It dated right back to the early 1920s, when there had been an undercover movement in Kenya, undercover African movement, trying to improve